Things have been moving really quickly the last few weeks. I wanted to start this episode by telling you when I interviewed my guest, who is Camille Burge Hicks, a political psychologist and professor of political science and the current chair of the political science department at Villanova University. And then I want to tell you where we are now. We spoke on July 25th. 4 days earlier, on July 21st, President Biden dropped out of the race. Later that same day, he endorsed his vice president, Kamala Harris, to replace him. The day before Camille and I spoke, Biden appeared in an Oval Office address to the nation, explaining his decision, stating that he did so to defend democracy, and saying of the campaign ahead, quote, America's going to have to choose between moving forward or backward, between hope and hate, between unity and division. And I think that sets up my conversation with Professor Burge Hicks perfectly. We discuss the history of polling, especially the history of polling among and about Black Americans, how polling inclusivity has improved in fits and starts, current challenges in representativeness in our sample frames. And then we started to talk about how to get at the more emotional drivers of civic participation and voter behavior. We violently agreed about the importance of incorporating more qualitative methods in both survey instruments and more generally. We talked about how we can usefully update our understanding of what various diagnostic questions are actually diagnosing, and the need for more testing and validation and innovation in survey question design. And we had a great conversation about how emotions, particularly the idea of real or perceived threat, might order our candidate and policy preferences in really interesting ways. This deep dive into the emotions of voters, beyond approval, disapproval, agreement, disagreement, is something I hope we explore more on this show and speaks to the themes Biden addressed in his Oval Office speech. Hope and hate, unity and division. I think these ideas are something that we can all dig our teeth into a little bit more. And I think this conversation that I had with Camille is something you'll really enjoy. And it might get you thinking differently about how we poll on more sensitive topics facing our country. So with that, here's my conversation with Professor Camille Burge Hicks.
I am Camille Burge Hicks. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Villanova University, and I'm also currently serving as chair of the department.
Talk a bit about your kind of specific area of research and expertise, because you have one of these incredibly impressive resumes, but also a very specific set of things that you're interested in as an academic.
Thank you. So I study political psychology and race and ethnicity in American politics. And my research really has three key areas. The first deals with Black-white relations, like how do Black and white people get along? How do they navigate racial dynamics, what that means for their public opinion and political engagement? The second is thinking about the role of emotions in politics. And this is probably the largest strand of my research, especially how we experience them as members of groups and what that means for our public opinion and political decision making. And right now, I focus a lot on emotional experiences of Black Americans. Most recently, I have a project looking at the emotions of women, diverse women. So Black women, Latinas, Asian Americans, white women, and what this means, especially for their non-electoral political behavior. The third strand of research, which also gets into that last part I was talking about, focuses on intersectionality. So I look at race and gender, race and class, more recently colorism in politics, and also race and sexuality, thinking about especially the politics of Black gay men and what comes first in terms of identity. So like the racial group identity, or is it being gay, or some combination, and what this means for political engagement. So those are pretty much my three strands. And throughout those strands, I use mixed methods, both qualitative and quantitative methods, content analyses, and I'm a trained survey experimentalist. So I analyze survey data, but I also create and program my own survey experiments using Qualtrics.
So I think I was actually introduced to your work by Ray Block, who we've had on the show a couple of weeks ago. He introduced me to your work. I found this great panel that I think you and David Wilson and Ray and maybe one other person were on. One of the things I hoped that you could take the audience through is something you talked about on that panel, which is kind of the origins of American political polling. And I think in particular, the racial component of that, both thinking about the work of W.E.B. Du Bois, but also the exclusion of Black voters by George Gallup and others. And if you could just root us in a little bit of history here about how polling has affected the Black community.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we're talking about polling and public opinion polls in particular, one of the things that I brought up in that conversation is when we think about public opinion in American politics, more often than not, people of color are targets of opinion as opposed to agents with opinions. And so what I mean by that is that if you were to go and search through like Gallup, Roper iPoll, any of the repositories that have survey questions that date back to the 1930s, you'd be able to find an avalanche of data pertaining to how white people feel about any group, but especially Black Americans, how they feel about things like interracial dating, bringing what they said in the data, not my words, bringing a Negro home for dinner, how they feel about Negroes living in their neighborhoods, Negroes in politics, giving Negroes a right to vote. The list goes on and on. And the thing that we lack in the survey community is that kind of data for people of color, generally speaking, but especially for Black Americans. And there have been attempts in the past to measure both the attitudes and experiences of Black Americans. As you mentioned, Du Bois was one of the first folks that tried to do this along with Isabel Eaton. I think in the late 1890s, like 1896, 1897, the Philadelphia Negro was published in 1899. It was based on 5,000 interviews, structured interviews that they created. And then Du Bois went on to conduct some of the first series of studies of Black communities for actually the Department of Labor, which helped to really set a foundation for the field of survey research in ways in which I don't think he gets enough credit for within political science and the folks that do survey research. So in those early years of polling, when Gallup and Roper were starting their enterprises, 1936-ish, on up through the 1940s, particularly Gallup, they didn't usually have Black voices in these polls, in part because of the sampling strategy that was used. Most of the polling data at that time was actually based on voting records. Election participation as one of the most important criteria in like setting quotas for these polls. So we know American history, we know that Black folks, specifically in the South, but throughout the United States, depending on where you live, were not legally allowed to vote. So these surveys, while they did have Black Americans from different portions of the United States, those numbers were incredibly small. And so there are some political scientists, Eric Schickler, Adam Berensky, they've been working with Roper to add weights to the little survey data that they do have on Black Americans to try and see what they can pull together. But it wasn't really until the 1960s that you start to get an understanding of Black public opinion. And even then, the sample sizes were really small. And so the responsibility really did fall on Black scholars to conduct this work. In 1979, Kenneth Clark and Black political and business leaders like Percy Sutton started this group called Data Black Public Opinion Polls with the thought of conducting polls of Black Americans quarterly. Like, we don't have this data, we don't have this information. It'd be great if we could do it, you know, once a quarter. But it was short-lived, but it was still known as one of the first like polling projects that we have. And so 1979, right? Like this is, you know, one of the first clear understandings that we end up having of Black public opinion in like U.S. history, which is insane when you think about that compared to like what we know about, you know, how white people have felt about Black folks for years, or just compared to like what we know about how white people feel about different aspects of politics. And certainly you would think somebody has to be doing polling on Black people during the civil rights movement. Not really, right? And so it's this idea that we have to consider racial bias in terms of sampling that's in representativeness, that's been also part of this story of polling, that's not just a contemporary issue, but has a much longer historical narrative than just like today we're having issues sampling racial and ethnic minorities. It's like, no, we've had them for an incredibly long time. So again, scholars have been the ones at the forefront doing this work. So we have the National Survey of Black Americans, which started in 1979, was a longitudinal study that lasted until the early 1990s. You then get things like the National Black Election Study, the National Black Politics Study that focus specifically on Black Americans, because even in the surveys that public opinion scholars use, like the ANES, American National Election Study, our key source of public opinion data that public opinion behavior scholars use, usually have really small samples of racial and ethnic minorities, unless it's 2008 and you're oversampling Black people because Obama's running. So more recently, more scholars of color and those that are interested in the politics of racial and ethnic minorities in the last few presidential election cycles have come together to put together like the CMPS. And the abbreviation, I think it's the Collaborative Multiracial Post-Election Study. I'd have to go back and look at it. But the CMPS has huge samples of racial and ethnic minorities. So what do I mean by huge? Like in a general ANES, you might have 3,000 respondents. And of those 3,000, you might have like 200 Black people, 200 racial ethnic subgroup folks. In the CMPS, they have like generally at least 2,000 people from each group, which is just amazing, right? When you're thinking Black Americans, you know, Latinos, the diversity within the Asian American community, along with white Americans, because they're included in the survey as well. But like huge, you know, sample size to be able to really make some in-depth comparisons and compare across things like, are you first generation, second generation, you know, third, is this your first language? You know, just like English, your first language. There's just all kinds of great things that they ask with huge samples of racial and ethnic minorities. But since we're talking about Black Americans especially. So still working, you know, in the polling industry writ large to try and find these larger samples of people of color, but especially of Black Americans. And it's not something that's like unique to this particular moment. It's a struggle that's been happening since polling, you know, really started and got off the ground the early 1900s.
Yeah. This is a super useful recitation of 100 years of polling. No, but it's perfect because I think it lays out the challenges. And I remember reading, I have a book called The Super Pollsters behind me, where he talked about Gallup having early on a kind of policy of 2-to-1 interviewing men over women, because the assumption was women would vote the way their husbands and fathers did, and also tended not to vote in as high of numbers as men. For a variety of reasons. Same thing with Black people. What's the point in surveying them if they're being prevented from voting in the first place? So, like, their vote's not going to get counted. Who cares what their opinions are, I guess,
really?
Is the idea.
Really?
And I think that this actually helps crystallize something that I was getting really irritated about yesterday listening to a podcast with a political reporter. And they were kind of gaming out, you know, you've got to do something for this demographic and that demographic, and the kind of issue tie, the sort of ticking and tying, okay, here's, you know, women care about healthcare and abortion, and Hispanic Americans care about immigration, and young people care about student loan forgiveness, and Black people care about crime and policing. In my parlance, I guess I would say that doesn't feel like targeting. That feels like stereotyping. And that, like, maybe those things are true. Maybe those issues do over-index for those groups. Maybe they don't. But when you look across, you know, what little you get out of crosstab data in national polling, 3,000 respondents, 200 Black people, that's not a representative sample. This makes me wonder about how do we then start to understand, I mean, assuming that voters even have some sort of policy-based checklist of things that they're taking with them into the polling place and going, okay, well, the candidate ticks all my top four boxes. Are we even capable of understanding what the top four boxes would be by any given demographic group? Or are we just sort of resorting to kind of lazy stereotypes about what we think the most important issues related to a particular demographic group are?
Oh, man, this has been like one of the things that I've been really concerned about for years. I mean, first is obviously dealing with representativeness in different samples. And the issue that we have is that even when you're able to reach these people in whatever the subgroups are, most of them tend to be like high education, high income. And so you may get a sample size that you find appealing, but most of the folks that are in that sample look the exact same. So they're not diverse, right? So you would end up with a lot of high ed, high income, perhaps Blacks or Latinos or Asian Americans. And to what extent is that representative of, you know, the issues that people in those groups might prioritize? It's probably not. And so to get back to the question about, like, what could we do to figure this out? Are there issues that people are prioritizing, and how would we find out basically what those things are, is what I feel like the question is. We would have to get really creative if we want to continue doing polling as a primary mechanism. we need to get more creative with our sampling strategy. One of the issues when you're doing polling with special samples, which racial and ethnic minorities are classified as, or if you were to focus on all women, that would be also a special sample, or all insert whatever group, it's like, how do you reach them? Mm-hmm. And so if you're doing things like census tracts and trying to figure out, well, this neighborhood has generally this amount of people. So if we're doing some kind of sampling strategy based on spatial location, maybe it would be better to sample places where Black people or Latinos are known to live, right? And then even then, does that keep your cross-section small? Because then that might end up being another kind of demographic mm-hmm. that might have different indicators for both education and income. So I think the best way to approach this is probably it's more qualitative work, but nobody wants to do that because it takes a lot of time. But you can imagine going to Black churches or Catholic churches that have a mass in Spanish, right? Or in Georgia, in the United Methodist Conference, there's a lot of Korean churches that are there. Like you could imagine if you were to go physically to these areas and talk to people, organize focus groups and talk to people, or attend meetings where you might have a critical mass of individuals from these groups, and then asking leaders of these organizations, so thinking about Kamala Harris and like the Divine Nine, Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated, they have chapter meetings for Black fraternities and sororities. It's not just an undergraduate thing. Like it seems to be for a lot of white fraternities and sororities. It's like a lifetime commitment. So trying to get in touch with presidents of these chapters and asking them if they can come and talk to members of the group or organize focus groups, you know, with members of those groups. In some of my work, I've ended up emailing lots of pastors and asking like, hey, I'd like to do focus group studies, you know, with people in your church. Would that be possible if you could help me organize it? You know, of course, IRB approved, but asking them to, you know, help me get groups of people together to answer different questions that I'd like answered for my research before I go and then do survey experiments. And so I think we could get creative in that way in terms of providing like more qualitative work and actually going to talk to people as opposed to like just assuming that we think we know what their issues are. And then there's also the point of, even if you didn't want to target certain issues like policing or immigration, there are consensus issues that you can appeal to that apply to everybody. Everybody mm-hmm. cares about wages. Everybody cares about inflation. Everybody cares about healthcare. Even if you wanted to appeal to consensus issues, that's also something you could do. The issue that I have with a lot of the literature in political science on racial and ethnic minorities reads as though immigration is the only issue that Latinos care about, or mm-hmm. affirmative action and welfare are the only issues that Black people care about, because we usually analyze them the most when we're talking about Black public opinion or the opinions of Latinos. Issues related to immigration, issues related to, you know, government funding of anything, or affirmative mm-hmm. action and hiring and promotion in other spaces. And so we don't really take the time to understand, like, how do other groups feel about this, unless it's white people, right? We know how white people feel about immigration. We know how white Americans feel about immigration. We know how white Americans feel about welfare and affirmative action. But even the questions that we have in the survey data, like about welfare that we use for political science, I pulled it up just because I was like, I hope she asked me a question about this. But even the question that we tend to use to gauge like welfare attitudes in our survey in the ANES, it says some people feel that government in Washington should make every effort to improve the social and economic position of Blacks. Suppose these people are at one end of the scale at 0.1. Others feel the government should not make any special effort to help Blacks because they should help themselves. Suppose people are at the other end at 0.7. And of course, some people have opinions somewhere in between. And then it asks you to say like where you feel, like where are you, you know, between 1 and 7. And so in my mind, I'm like, well, white people receive welfare too, right? But like, but we don't know how people feel about white recipients of government funding or other things, because like, that's not how the question is worded. So there's like a mm-hmm. few issues, you know, that are here that we need to talk about. The first is representativeness and sampling strategies. I think the second are also about how do we get to those people, right? So if the survey mm-hmm. polls aren't going to be representative, are there other methods that we can use to get to those people? There are. We just don't necessarily want to use them because they may be more expensive when we try to do this targeting. And then the third thing is also thinking about the kinds of questions that we ask in surveys and who we ask them to and who we're analyzing like that data among. All of these things, I think, contribute to conversations surrounding representativeness in public opinion, in polling and public opinion research. And just all of that contributes to our general understanding of what's happening within these groups with their attitudes as well.
I'm so glad that you went in this direction because you used a phrase that just spoke to me. I mean, obviously, my primary practice is as a qualitative researcher. And so saying a phrase that I think was something like, well, if we want to keep doing polling as our way of doing this.
Yeah.
And I was like, yes, maybe there's something else. But also a standard of our practice, whenever we do any kind of quantitative work, we do qualitative first because we need to make sure that we're doing statement batteries, or if we're trying to figure out what type of question type to use, is it a scaled response or a multi-select or a sorting exercise or a highlighting exercise? I mean, there's a million things we can do with survey instruments now. The question is always, are we speaking in the language of the people we want to survey, or are we speaking in the language of our client or what we usually do?
Yeah.
And we attempt to talk about these things in ways that sound like the people we interviewed instead of in ways that sound like, you know, whatever we did last time. And this shows up in a couple of ways. And so like the analogy I would give is, you know, I've had clients who do brand trackers and they have various brand attributes that they're measuring over time. How much do people associate these characteristics with a slate of brands? Mm-hmm. And what's always hilarious is then we go talk to people and we find out that those characteristics, some of them, are just completely irrelevant to anyone's priorities in the category. And others, it turns out, people, ordinary folks, are not using the same working definitions of those terms as the brand is using. Like they think, you know, energetic means something, but actually it means something else, right? And so like they have misunderstood what that characteristic represents to people. But this, you know, immigration, I think, is a great one where you get these, you know, I'm getting all kinds of surveys because I'm in finally a competitive congressional district, apparently. And so it's new for our congressional district. But the, you know, the survey question where it asks about, you know, immigration and the border. And I always just kind of freeze slightly looking at that topic. Because what are we talking about? Are we talking about, you know, immigration judges? Are we talking about asylum policies? Are we talking about seasonal migration? Are we talking about people who have family here? Are we talking about people who have not gained citizenship but have been married to a U.S. citizen, have U.S. citizen children? Like, which things are we talking about? Yeah. Because immigration and the border is a basket of issues.
Right.
It is not a single issue.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, this is the thing about survey construction and design. So I will say there's a lot of pretesting that goes into a number of questions in political science, especially the ones that we use on our surveys that have been, you know, validated for years. Right. But when you're talking about these issues like immigration, there's so many aspects of it that people may have different opinions on. And so when I'm teaching public opinion and political behavior, I spend probably about at least 2 weeks talking about polling and dealing with things like survey construction and design, dealing with things like question wording and response options, and making sure that questions that we ask are balanced in terms of it being like both negative and positive, not just all negative, really drawing on Herb Asher's book, Polling in the Public, being one of the tools that I use to teach my students about how to properly construct surveys and the importance of doing so. We have these broad topics like immigration, and somebody sends you a text message like, how do you feel about immigration? And you're like, are we talking about asylum seekers? Are we talking? I watch 90 Day Fiance, all of my K-9 visa folks stand up. Like, are we talking about mirroring into relationships and how that works? There's just so many different aspects of immigration that we're just not able to gauge. And part of the issue with existing academic surveys is we only have so much space to ask these questions. Mm-hmm. I get maybe 1 to 3 shots to ask a question about immigration. So my shots are going to be, what do you think about the number of immigrants? Should it be increased, decreased, kept the same? Which is like a standard question that we ask, but not really grappling with all of the details that might go into one's opinion about immigration as a very large, all-consuming topic. And so I think we definitely need to do a better job of that as well. There's just all kinds of limitations. It's funding. who has the money to ask a 15, 20 minute survey that's devoted specifically to issues on immigration? Not a lot of academics that I know. Mm-hmm. So you try and get your questions in where you can on these surveys that have nationally representative samples. It's not the exact questions that you want to put in there, but it's like, I can just get a little idea about something. I think that's part of the issue, but we could definitely do a better job if there were more funds available. If people engaged in more pre-testing of questions. So a lot of folks now in the survey world use programs like Mechanical Turk to like test questions. You might also use student samples to test questions to figure out what you should actually be asking before you end up putting them on a survey. So I think there's lots of thoughtful testing that happens to get to the questions that we see, but it still doesn't answer your question about like, there's so many different aspects of immigration that I have opinions about. So when you ask me that question, I'm not able to provide like a cogent response because I may feel X way about this aspect of immigration, but this particular way. And so the question is not really capturing what I know to be like my true thoughts and feelings on a given topic.
So obviously, I'm always going to be the person who looks at a survey and goes, interesting, but what do they mean?
One of the things that I've done in my research with Cindy Kam, we did these stop and reflect measures. So if you're doing survey research, you can get like a qualitative component to understand what people are thinking. So in our paper, we read a paper on racial resentment and how Blacks and white Americans respond to this measure, this racial resentment battery, which is supposed to measure more implicit racial attitudes. So it's a four-question measure for anyone that's unfamiliar with it. One of the measures says, like, Irish, Italians, and Jewish people, like, work their way up without any special favors. Black people should do the same. Or, like, generations of slavery make it difficult for Black people to get ahead. And so there's four questions that political scientists use. Sociologists tend to use 6 to 8, but we use about 4 in our battery. Some are reverse coded so that the people that are at the top of the scale are considered more racially resentful. The ones that are at the low end of the scale are not. And so we wanted to know, I was like, well, how do Black people feel about this? Because they've been asked this battery of questions since 1986 as well. You know, does it actually predict, you know, their political attitudes as much as it predicts white people's attitudes? And does it look similar? Does it look different? What's going on, right? Because there can be Black folks that respond to this battery, like, in a racially resentful way as well, getting at tropes of like individualism and being hardworking. And so one of the things that we did in the survey when we had it was after each of those questions, we asked respondents like, so you just answered this to the previous question, like, you know, the preload the answer. Can you please explain to us what was going through your mind as you answered that question? So then we not only have the actual survey responses to the four questions that we care about, we have really rich qualitative data that didn't take long to collect at all, but took long to analyze, you know, because you're talking about 4 responses, 4 open-ended responses per respondent. It's a lot of data. So you're able to get that richness there with the quick stop and reflect, which is also a tool that I think pollsters may be interested in using. So imagine if you were to receive that question about immigration. And it says, like, well, you just answered, I'm not really sure about how I feel about whatever aspect of immigration they asked you about. Can you explain why you selected that answer? And you would type, well, here are my thoughts about these particular aspects of immigration. So now the researcher, once they receive your responses, they're like, this person's thinking about more than insert whatever when I'm asking about immigration and broadly construed. So maybe I should be considering these other things as well. Like that would be something helpful that we could do as well. Folks that are doing surveys and especially practitioners that use polls, pollsters in particular, instead of just these like one shot, very broad questions, maybe a little stop and reflect. And you can actually get some really good data from the inclusion of maybe one of those measures that you would otherwise not have. So then you actually know, here are the things that people care about.
Hi. It's just me. I wanted to take a quick break in this conversation to let you know that I'm not just a podcaster who can't get enough of the technical details of polling. I'm also the founder of a research and strategy consultancy focused on helping leaders get real about their customers and decide to grow. We combine qualitative and quantitative research built on high-quality data, brand marketing, and product-led go-to-market strategy with an eye on the latest in behavioral and marketing science to help brands make big decisions. If you're interested in what we do, you can always get in touch with me at www.thedifferenceengine.co. I hope to hear from you. I love this approach, and I think it's also related to another kind of related question. I know we talked about the racial resentment score before, and I've also spoken with David Wilson about his work on racial resentment and hoping to get him on the show soon. But some of these indices have been around for a long time and are directionally useful, have been validated in whatever way that they've been validated. Mm-hmm. I guess I have a undergrad question for you. Which is like, cultures change, norms shift. And some of these measures, when I look at them, I feel like you can guess who wrote them.
Yeah.
Demographically, right? And it's like, okay, 50 plus white guy in academia wrote that question in the 1970s. Is it still relevant? Is that still how people actually experience, you know, whether it's racial resentment or anything else? I mean, obviously, like, the immigration question is kind of a funny one for me. I am married to an immigrant. I mean, he's English, but he's an immigrant nevertheless. He's now a U.S. citizen. Mm-hmm. So I'm always going to hit that question differently because I've actually sat in immigration offices having conversations about visas and green cards and citizenship. Mm-hmm. I've had to prove that I really am married to this guy and that I really do know him, that we have met before. But there are some of these questions, like that question about Italians and Jews have, like, this is not, this feels anachronistic in some ways. And maybe for some groups of people in the population, it's less anachronistic. I would imagine, like, I don't know. I maybe it's because, look, I'm from Portland, Oregon. Everybody's white except who's not. And it's the West Coast also, where your whiteness is sort of like no longer ethnically identified.
Sure, yeah.
And so living in the Northeast, it's very different. It is ethnically identified. But I guess my question is this. Are we sure that these indicators, these indices are as well theorized as we hoped? Do they need to be re-theorized? How often do we kind of update our understanding of these types of measures?
Yeah. So, I mean, going back to that paper that I wrote with Cindy, it's like the measures are still useful, right? But maybe what we call the measure is not, right? Maybe what it's capturing is structural versus individual attributions of blame for like where Black people are in American society. And so the questions still useful, but what we call the battery is maybe not that useful. And so we said in our paper, in our Journal of Politics paper, we suggested that we recast the racial resentment battery as structural versus individual attributions for Black Americans, economic and social status. That's not a pretty name, like racial resentment. But like, this is what this scale is actually capturing. Are you saying that it's because basically people are, you know, lazy and don't want to work hard? That's where they are. Failures of individualism in society, or are there government structures, right? And these other important forces, laws, you know, that have helped to subjugate a particular group of people. So it's not that the battery isn't useful. It's like, if we want to apply the battery to other people, and if we want to update the battery to help make it make sense in this particular era, that maybe we need to recast, maybe we need to rename what it's actually doing. They're placing the blame for social and economic disadvantage on the individualistic ethos, like whether or not somebody worked hard or did not, or whether or not there were other structural factors in place that hindered them from that progress. And so I think that's one of the things that we can do, right? It's not that we have to get rid of all of these questions. Maybe we recast the questions. Maybe we do more of the qualitative work to understand what's going into people's opinions when they're answering these traditional scales or indices that we have in a contemporary era. One of the things that I found when I was doing focus group studies with Black Americans, this was in, it would have been in 2012, 2013. I was talking to Black churchgoers about their emotions and how they connected to their politics. Mm-hmm. And at the end, I asked them to fill out a little survey questionnaire just so I could also have some survey data to gauge their demographic factors. It was anonymous. When they were answering like the stereotype measures that we often use about scales related, like going 1 to 7, hardworking, lazy to hardworking, scales related to intelligence, related to violence. I had them using these scales, and this was, you know, over a decade ago. And the first thing that someone that was filling out the survey said, like, these stereotype batteries are racist, you know, like, and so I was like, yeah, you know, after we were done with the focus group, I was like, should we be asking these questions in this particular way? These are questions that we ask for like all groups, but it's something that I come back to often, this idea that what we know about welfare and or affirmative action and most of the survey data that we have is only limited to Blacks. There's nothing that asks about affirmative action for white women, which we should be asking because, you know, they're beneficiaries of affirmative action as well. But we don't have any survey data that would recognize that because most of the data that we have that's about affirmative action or welfare, however the questions are constructed, the target group is usually Black Americans or Black people. Mm-hmm. So I think that in those cases, we certainly need to update these questions and include more groups. Or in other cases, like with the racial resentment battery, maybe it's just a recasting and use of qualitative data to understand what's actually going in to people's answers. So I'm definitely with you on this idea that a lot of these questions were created a very long time ago, and thinking about the extent to which they still capture what's going on. And what I will say is if they didn't, they wouldn't be on the surveys. There are different things that we have to ask about now that we just didn't before. So like questions about non-binary individuals, like even when you're asking the gender identification question, for years, there was no non-binary response. There was no category for same-sex marriage. And thinking about when people ask you questions about whether or not you're married, it's just like, mm-hmm. yes, you're married, or being cishet or not, like those kinds of questions just didn't exist. That doesn't mean right. that LGBTQ people also didn't exist. It just means that we weren't capturing their identities and we were not able to measure how those different identities might shape their politics in ways in which folks that don't have those identities might feel about politics. Those things are slowly changing, which are good signs, but I think that there's still a lot more work that, you know, we need to do to recast or update scales or update questions so they're not so targeted towards certain groups and become like more inclusive in the polling, in the polling industry. Just because a question's been asked for 50 years doesn't mean that it can't change, or if it's been cast a certain way since like 1986 for 37, 38 years, that doesn't mean that the interpretation of that battery like can't change. We can start to, you know, incorporate that understanding into how we then discuss what was known as racial resentment. So, I mean, people will not be happy, but
well,
there's,
you know,
there's still good social science to be done here. And I think a lot of it can come from modifying existing measures, creating new ones that we know have relevance, that have been validated, and just doing the work. It's easy to kind of continue putting existing measures on surveys. It's hard to produce your own and figure out what you should or could be measuring.
You talked about this with the emotional component of political opinion. And because I think people have emotional responses to the questions themselves. People respond to public polling emotionally. People interpret public polling emotionally. And yet I feel like most of the questions that you see on a national poll conducted by, you know, pick your favorite newspaper or TV news division or whatever, the emotional questions tend to be things like, I don't know, enthusiasm about voting, approval or favorability, which still feel like they're tilting more towards the rational than the emotional in some respects. You do get to things that feel very, you know, some of the kind of characteristics, like which candidate is strong, which candidate is whatever. That strong feels like multi-coded, like there's gender there and there's emotion there and there's other kind of cultural codes there. But maybe talk about where are the emotional questions? Where do we start to think about people's emotional affect in relationship to their political choices? Because it seems like there's a lot of emotion happening amongst voters and amongst the parties and everybody else. And so why don't we seem to ask more about that in public polling? I'm sure that we do in political science, but maybe talk about the challenges there.
People are in their feelings about a lot of different things. We can talk about a lot of different groups feeling angry, anxious, afraid, enthusiastic, pride, hopeful on both sides of the aisle. You don't see a lot of that in polling, broadly construed. In political science, the work on emotions, at least like the survey research on emotions, really started to jump off in the late 90s. The survey question that's typically used to measure emotions in political science research is a question that's candidate-centric. The question says, we'll just use Donald Trump as the example, has Donald Trump, because of something he's said or done, ever made you feel, insert emotion, angry, afraid, anxious? I think they have ashamed, and I think they have pride. So for years, these have been the questions that people use to predict attitudes about immigration or predict people's attitudes about a wide range of policy opinions. And to a lesser extent, their support for candidates like vote choice, vote intention, feeling thermometers, a wide range of dependent variables. And so where my work really comes in with that is looking at psychology research that have been studying emotions forever. You know, they've been doing this work for a very long time. One of the things that psychology researchers talk a great deal about is that emotions have all kinds of attitude objects or stimuli that you're responding to. And so the way that the question is worded within political science research really focuses on the actions and words of candidates, right? Which is hugely important for elections. But political elites aren't the only things that people are emotionally reacting to and that are having an effect on their vote choice. So, or a wide range of dependent variables that are related to politics beyond, you know, vote choice, like protesting, donating money to candidates, signing petitions, talking to your friends about politics, attending local board meetings, things like that. It's not just what these candidates say. People have opinions about a lot of things. So thinking about banning books, thinking about reproductive rights, thinking about police killing unarmed individuals of color, right? These are a lot of different targets that can bring about a wide range of emotions for people. And so what I do in my work is talk about what are some of those things? And also, like, how do we experience emotions as members of groups? Right? Politics are group-centric. How you feel or think as a partisan or as a woman or as a Black person, maybe somebody that might be Latino or a person of color or intersectional identities, all of those things work together to inform your politics. So while the polling data writ large doesn't tend to deep dive into emotions, psychology scholars have been doing it for a very long time. Political scientists are coming to the table, of course, with these candidate-centric questions. More recently, people doing work on the emotions of partisans under the topic of affective polarization, thinking about how Republicans and Democrats feel as members of these partisan groups and what that means for their politics, but not as much work dealing with like racial and ethnic minorities. Davin Phoenix and his work dealing with the anger gap focused on Blacks and whites. There have been a few articles here and there that deal with Black people and their emotions. My work in particular, focusing on anger and pride that I have published and my forthcoming book that hopefully will be out early next year. Fired up, ready to go, Pride, Shame, and Anger in Black Politics. So there's that. There's a few works dealing with Latinos and fear surrounding what? Immigration, like we just talked about. It exists and it's growing. I think that strand of research in political psychology is only going to get bigger because literally we emotionally react to things every single day. We plug in group identities and different things in politics that are happening on a daily basis. You can combo that in any way to come up with an interesting research topic or a paper or even an entire book manuscript. So I think it's a really promising area of research within political science and political psychology. And I would hope, you know, that more pollsters would ask more questions about emotions, because I think that they're doing a great deal more work than we currently have the data to analyze. How do white Americans really feel about America becoming a majority minority nation? That's a real consideration for some of these individuals that are voting. Idea of like displacement. How do Black people feel about police killing unarmed individuals of color or pay equity issues? A lot of different things that go into people's opinions are very much so based on group membership and emotions. And I don't know that we have as many questions in the polling industry as we could or should that really get at those things that are happening. And that can help us explain, you know, the dynamics and how we see them play out in the election cycle, but just in the everyday world, like people going to school board meetings, school board meetings being packed now.
Never.
And so like, what are the
things packed by kids, maybe people who don't have kids in the school district.
You don't even go here. Like your kid doesn't even go here. What are you doing there? Like, what are you so fired up about? Right. And so like understanding that there's people on both sides of this discussion, like Moms for Liberty that are very concerned about what their children are reading in schools and other folks that are really concerned about books pertaining to their history being banned or their lived experiences being banned. And so it's like, oh, yeah, well, I'm upset about that. Or I'm anxious about the fact that my kid won't have the opportunity to learn this if they're in this particular school system. These are real concerns. And I don't think that we're capturing them as well as we could be capturing them with the polling data that we have access to. So that would be my hope. Please ask more questions about groups and emotions.
Yeah, it also feels like there is a lot of research being done about this. National polling in election years gets covered.
That's right.
That's the political science research that gets talked about publicly.
Right.
And then it does seem like we wind up almost being in, almost voters who pay attention to this stuff anyway, are sort of in dialogue with the polls themselves. Like they're finding out that other voters feel a certain kind of way about things and then having responses to that. The conversations that were had earlier in the year about, or even into last year, about are presidential approval ratings and favorability ratings actually related to vote intention anymore, or are they becoming disentangled from one another? Does it matter if I tell a pollster that I don't love this candidate, but I'm going to vote for him anyway? I think the other thing I think about is, I mean, in all kinds of categories, I touch the kind of emotional affect of people thinking about, for example, going back to finally get a bachelor's degree as a working adult after probably trying multiple times and not quite finishing, you know, or not being able to do it when they wanted to do it, not being able to finish when they wanted to finish. Life intervenes and knocks you off course. The emotional relationship to the decision to go back to school is different for them than for like a middle class kid about to graduate from high school whose parents went to college and have lots of support structures and can afford it and all of that. And so the things that matter most to them in selecting a school, for example, are going to be different because one is coming to it with more anxiety, frankly, than the other group. When some of those folks who are returning may feel more, it may not be as extreme as this, but something like shame because they have tried and failed previously. And so will they be setting themselves up to fail again versus the 18-year-old kid from Cherry Hill who's just going to go to Penn and he knows he's going to be fine. That kid doesn't have the same anxieties. So his school selection criteria is different. I've been thinking a lot about the shift over the last week of people going from Sarah Longwell uses this phrase that I love about like knife in the teeth kind of way of getting to the end of this election and like going from that sort of a grim determination to vote for your preferred candidate to enthusiasm.
Sure.
Does that change the issues that matter most to you? Like your emotional affect, does it reorder the things that you care about because you're almost kind of working backwards from, well, I really love this candidate. You know, people who really love Trump but don't have strong policy priors, like, do they reorder their policy priors because they love Trump? Will people who were supporting Biden shift around their policy priors based on their enthusiasm or not for Kamala? This is the thing I've been wondering about. And I don't know if you know the answer, but I'm going to ask you anyway.
Yeah. Does it change issue prioritization among other things? I don't know. I don't have a good answer to that. I think that's a wonderful, you know, research project to look at. What we know in the literature and the data, Evelyn Simeon has a book called Historic First. In her work, she talks about how if a candidate is a historic first, Barack Obama being like the archetypal example of this, right, that creates a certain level of pride, a certain level of enthusiasm, gins up this joyful reaction of people that might identify with that group, which leads to greater political engagement. That doesn't say anything about issue prioritization, though, right? That's just different political participation that happens, not just the vote, but you might start canvassing. You might engage in all these other activities, donating money to help get a candidate elected. among other things that she finds. That doesn't say anything about the question that you asked pertaining to issues that I think is a really interesting one. When I think about this in connection to the recent race, some of the comments that I've been seeing on like social media is like, so people are just going to support Kamala without knowing what her policy stances are? And that's a real question that people have. You're just going to let that enthusiasm, that positive emotion that you might have, drown out any policy relevance that you might be interested in exploring. So
yeah,
I'm not aware of scholarship that might exist that would engage that question about prioritizing different issues and it drowning out. I think what I would think would happen based on the existing literature would be something along the lines of perhaps those positive or negative emotions can drown out whatever the policy stances might be in support mm-hmm. of whatever that final electoral goal. And I think that you could probably pull from the affective polarization folks to make that argument, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's like, perhaps at some point your party identification would drown out your disagreements with the issues that somebody else might have, right? And so this idea that after you get through the primaries and you're stuck with your general election candidate, you may not agree 100% with them on all of the issues, but because they're a member of the party that you support, you're still going to support them, right? So yeah. There are people on both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans, that will never support the party for any reason. And so I think it's an interesting question to think about, like, is there a way that emotions could change that? Is there a way that emotions mm-hmm. could change the way that you're prioritizing issues, like how you feel? I don't know. I feel like you could just definitely see that on both sides right now with yeah. people that might be more inclined to support former President Trump, thinking about majority minority status, thinking about immigration mm-hmm. in particular, this idea that even if you don't support Donald Trump, the Democratic Party may not stand for any of that, or they might mm-hmm. not know any of that. And so I'm really angry about these issues. I don't care who's atop the Republican ticket. I'm supporting the Republican candidate. Or if you're a woman that is pro-choice, you may feel really unsettled about the things that are happening throughout state legislatures surrounding reproductive rights. You don't care who's atop the ticket. Mm-hmm. You're still voting for the Democratic Party. So I think that if this is the case, I would think that like partisanship might drown out these other things. We're talking about like partisanship and emotions, because you understand that the opposite party is not at all going to champion whatever those issues are. And so you're yeah. going to stick with whoever's at the top of your ticket. I think there's a good project here to be done thinking about issue prioritization and emotions yeah. and the extent to which things can get drowned out. That's a good project.
It's an interesting question, even in some of the issues you mentioned, where like, yeah, there were a lot of people who did not say that reproductive health was an important question for them in their vote choice. And then we get the Dobbs decision, and suddenly when you look at crosstabs by gender, it starts to get into like number three. That feels like a thing that is like, there's a shock. Well, I was taking for granted that Roe would never be overturned. And I also wasn't really thinking about abortion, including people with ectopic pregnancies or with other kind of healthcare crises in the midst of pregnancy. I was just thinking about those loose girls in high school or whatever. And then they were like, oh, you mean that would have included me? And that sort of shock and it coming home emotionally about what it means sure. suddenly changes the response to that question.
Yeah.
I think we saw some of that in the summer of 2020 as well, with people getting to some kind of peak, may or may not have been sustained, around police violence against unarmed people of color. And like suddenly, what are we going to do about the cops became like an issue for even white Democrats who might not have thought about it previously.
Yeah.
There's some of it that maybe there are hints there in those kind of moments of public wake up yeah. to a particular issue, where the emotional response drives a policy preference and then that drives a party or candidate preference. I don't know.
I'm thinking about like sociology and psych research on threat that mm-hmm. might be like instrumental in this conversation. So maybe it's not that emotions are doing the work. I mean, emotions clearly have a job to do here. But right. thinking about real versus imagined threats, like mm-hmm. heightened threat sensitivity
yep.
towards particular issues, might also heighten like fear and anxiety. And then move those issues to the top of your list, whereas before they weren't. So there's some event like a Supreme Court ruling or a police shooting or something that might change how you would prioritize that. In my mind, when you asked that question, didn't immediately go to like threat, because you asked about it in the context of emotions, but like, I think that's what it would actually fit into in that literature. And then like from that threat, the stimulus is the threat or whatever's happening.
Right.
I would also imagine that suburban white women who are based on the data that we have access to, the ones most likely to use IVF, who would have been otherwise sitting this conversation about reproductive health out, but for certain states deciding or starting to at least discuss legislation that would also bar access from like IVF. I know a number of women that were like, I don't support abortion. I'm pro-life all the way, but IVF? What if I want to have my baby? I've already frozen my eggs. And so this wasn't an issue for those women, but now it is. So I would think that my mind, after talking through this, immediately goes to the threat literature. And the realistic group conflict threat literature is huge. But real versus imagined threat and how that might change, how that might activate some kind of emotion. And then that's what actually ends up changing the behavior. And like every election, different issues are magnified for the parties. So for example, in 2018, the issue that's magnified is the Me Too movement in particular,
right?
Just as an example. And so what happens in 2018, you get some of like the highest rates of turnout that we've seen among women across racial and ethnic groups in decades, for turnout of people running for state and local office, for women running for Congress even. A lot of that you could talk about in terms of their reaction to Me Too, but when you're thinking about it, it's like the threat response. It's legitimately, and you know, the emotions that accompany that response that might lead to people engaging in politics, right? So anger, and you're angry about what's been happening with women, what might have happened to you in terms of sexual assault, sexual violence as a woman. And you decide that you want to champion those issues, you decide to run for politics, right? Or you decide to support candidates that also support the Me Too movement or women's rights in different ways. Yeah. It's about the event, but it's the threat. It's not just the emotion. It's about what actually could happen, perceived real threat versus perceived imagined threat, and then how you're reacting to that emotionally, and then in turn, the behavior that occurs.
In framing it that way, you've also made me think about, I was talking to these folks from Valens Games, and Amal Ali, who's the SVP of strategy there, was talking about fear-based marketing as being a challenge. I'll put it mildly in this way. And coming out of the advertising industry as I do, there's always kind of a conversation about, do we want to, like a lot of marketing that is aimed at moms is fundamentally fear-based marketing. If you're afraid you're going to break the baby, then you should buy Pampers. And so there's a lot that kind of capitalizes on that. Even if it's showing you warm and fuzzy scenarios, there is still this playing on your fear of being a bad parent that is happening there. And so the way you ward off being a bad parent is buy the right products, right? Or you're afraid of being unattractive, and so buy these products and then you won't be unattractive. But on the other side of it, there are messages that are meant to be aspirational, hopeful, you imagining your better self and trying to buy products and services that you think will help you achieve your better self. And it's not so much leaning on the reject your not better self. It is on the point yourself in the direction of whatever, you know, just do it to some degree is this idea of if you have a body, you're an athlete, we've already affirmed you, now get out there and go for a jog or whatever. But I wonder about that in political messaging. But the way you framed it that's interesting to me is in the sort of the white people discourse around race in candidates like Kamala Harris or Barack Obama or who have you, there is this, is it going to spark feelings of racial resentment? I saw some commentary about, do white women need to do the work to be okay with a black woman skipping over them in the chain of who gets to be president? On the other hand, it did seem like there was some writing about white people who voted for Obama doing so in part because they don't like thinking of themselves as racist. Yep. And so to ward that off, they will be sure to vote for the candidate that proves they're not, right? Like the worst thing you can do as a white person is be accused of being a racist. And so I prove I'm not by voting for the black candidate. I wonder about like that's more also a threat of like, I don't want to be accused mm-hmm. of being racist. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I also wonder about the flip side of it, which is just like that weighs the future and the need for catharsis after a lot of threat, the need to feel like we're moving away from threat, even if only temporarily.
Thinking about the political environment that we're in right now, some of the comments that I've been reading online and seeing in different outlets is like, is America as a whole in the position right now to overwhelmingly support a woman of color for president? We'll find out in November. Like when you think about the racial dynamic, racial and gendered dynamics happening mm-hmm. in politics right now, it could go either way.
Right.
There could be white folks that will turn out for whoever's at the top of the ticket, like you just talked about, like mm-hmm. whoever is atop the Democratic ticket, even if it is a woman of color.
And well, some of the polling looks like that there's like a stable 43% who are going to vote for whoever the Democrat is. Yeah.
I mean, some of the polling that I've seen, some of the indicators that I've seen is like, oh, actually, there's a lot of white Americans that would get behind this candidate. But there's a number of white folks that would also not support her because she's, you know, a woman of color, and a number of people of color that also a lot mm-hmm. of people just in general.
Right.
That will, regardless of race and ethnicity, that won't support her, maybe because she's a woman or mm-hmm. maybe because they just don't believe she's the best candidate to do the job. It would be multiple reasons mm-hmm. on both sides that could be specifically about race or gender, or could be policy focused or not. Like, we'll just have to see.
So the question at the very end, I wanted to, I mean, I have 1,000 questions I'd love to ask you. But I think a thing I am curious about is, in most of the interviews I have done up to this point, one of the things that pollsters have said to me, journalists have said to me, is that there is this role to play for the public in being like responsible consumers of public polling. And part of me feels like, is it the layperson's job to be sophisticated about margins of error and sample frames and that sort of thing? Or are we talking about something else? And I'm curious from your perspective, do you think that's the burden of the reader? Do you think that's the burden of the news outlet reporting on polls? Is that what we mean when we say being a better consumer of public polling? Where do you come down on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that consumers need to be better consumers of polls, and journalists need to be better reporters of polls. Pollsters are always going to give you the top lines, whatever they have available on the data that they want to, you know, publicly share. It's just, how are those things being interpreted by the masses as well as like by journalists? So I think there's a few things that the public should know, and any journalists, hopefully the ones that do the reporting on polls are the ones that are familiar, you know, with polling practices. Like, this is kind of what they do.
That I think there has been some improvement on that score over the last several years. More pollsters involved.
I agree with that. But I think generally things that people should know about polls is that there's wide variation and not a great deal of standardization. But I think that's something that folks that write about it and consumers should be aware of. So variation, the length of the survey, the number of questions, the amount of time it takes to complete this survey, that we're using landlines, mm-hmm. cell phones, robocalling, is it online polls? Variation in the time that the survey might be in the field, 1 to 7 days. What was happening during those 1 to 7 days or longer that it was in the field? I think for anybody consuming and those interpreting those results, especially like from the journalist end, but also from the broader population, and we need to take this wide variation into consideration as we're reading headlines. And usually there's always something that says like, click the link to learn more, you know, about this poll. And so I think the advice that I would give to people is click the link, actually read. I think for folks that are writing about polls and surveys, when you have a headline that says 58% of Americans believe, insert whatever they believe, you click on click here for more information. And it's like, we surveyed 150 people. And you're like, huh? You know, we surveyed 350 people. And so I think a more honest headline would be something, it's not sexy, but it's like 54% of Americans polled in this survey believe X. Right. But that's not like sexy. That's not catchy. That's not going to get people to click, you know, on what right. you've written. So doing even a bit more signposting, if you're not going to put it in the title, a bit more signposting in the article. We conducted this survey on these days. This is the amount of people that are in the survey. Give the reader some indication on perhaps who was included in the surveys. So like, does it lean Republican or does it lean, you know, Democrat? This is something that happened, you know, in 2012 in particular, that a couple of networks ended up having to apologize for, because quite a bit of the polling data in 12, you know, was talking about how Obama like wasn't going to win. And so that was one of the thoughts going into the 2012 election. And I think like maybe CNN and Fox, I would have to go back and look at it just to be sure. But a few major networks issued like apologies after that election because they had been like oversampling Republicans. And so no duh, you oversample members of the opposite party. Like this is going to give you, you know, results that are skewed, even if folks that are writing about the survey or its results could do a sentence or two that explains who's in the sample. Mm-hmm. The sample had 1,500 individuals with these particular demographic indicators. The person reading understands that it's not really all of America that feels this way. It's just the folks that you had included in your poll in particular. And then, of course, all the things related to variation that I mentioned. So if you could pick one sentence that gives right. the reader an understanding of who was included in this survey. Most of the write-ups do have the sample size somewhere in the article, but it could just be really small print underneath the title that has mm-hmm. some of these demographic factors, sample sizes, the number of individuals from each group that was included, like 1,500 people, and 40 of them were Black. Having that knowledge, you would understand that maybe this is not a position that the overwhelming majority of individuals like in my group or groups that I identify might have. Or maybe if it was landline and not cell phones, that's also going to change your understanding of who was included in the sample and how likely you are to believe that there's a critical mass of people that have those same opinions.
Yeah, that's a good place for us to end. And also, it's kind of the way this whole show got started was maybe we'd all freak out a little less about the polls if we knew a little bit more about how they worked and thought of them as interesting data, but not predictions for the future and not things to get too worked up about on any given poll.
Absolutely.
You start seeing a whole bunch of polls going in a direction that scares the hell out of you. That's a different story, but that's really, really good advice. So yeah. I've already taken more time than I bargained for, Camille, but it was really nice to talk to you. Yes.
You go it. You do research together.
Oh my God, I would love to. Not going to lie, I would love to. This weekend, we got the results of a new poll from New York Times Siena College among voters in three swing states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, now show Harris winning by 4 points in every one among likely voters. Among registered voters, she leads Trump by 5 in Wisconsin, 3 in Pennsylvania, and is lagging Trump by 2 points in Michigan. Among Democrats, 87% are now enthusiastic about their candidate choice, up 27 points from May. Overall, voters are 15% more likely to say they are satisfied with their candidate choices for the elections happening this fall. Last week, on August 6, Harris announced her vice presidential running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. For reference, the New York Times Siena poll was conducted August 5th through 8th in Michigan and Wisconsin and August 6th through 9th in Pennsylvania. So it's unclear how this data changes based on when that announcement was made or whether or not everyone was aware of it. But rest assured, there will be more polls. There are 83 days until the 2024 election. Crosstabs is hosted by me, Farah Bostic, production by The Difference Engine, and edited by me. Music from Audio Jungle by S Audio. Find us at crosstabspodcast.com, where you can subscribe to our weekly Substack, also available at crosstabspod.substack.com. Tell your friends about the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast service, and give the show a rating or review. I would love to hear from you. Email me if you have any questions, ideas for episode topics, suggestions for future guests, or want to talk about ways we can work together at farah@crosstabspodcast.com. See you next time.